Hey, what's up, sinners and choosers? Welcome to Choose Your Own Religion. My name is Joe. Thank you so much for tuning in this week. My guest today is Khadija Ali. Khadija is a fellow student here at Harvard Divinity School. She has been in one of my classes this semester in one of our little seminar breakout sections, and I've been hankering to get her on the show. And I love this conversation. I can't wait to see where Khadija goes in her career with her life. She's got a super bright future in front of her, and I can't wait to see what she does. If you like this episode, go to chooseyourownreligion.com. You can find all the old episodes on there. You can find a blog that I am slowly blogging away on. You can mention it to a friend, recommend it to a buddy. You can subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, whatever. Whatever your podcast thing is, you can subscribe and get more of these straight to your dome. While you're there, if you're like, I loved this episode, dare I say I am deeply moved by it. If that has the kind of emotional resonance, you could even leave a rating or review. I'm not telling you how to live your life. These are merely some options at your fingertips. Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much for listening. Please give it up for Khadija Ali.
Allow the soothing music and uplifting affirmations to center your heart and mind in an awareness of God's love.
Wake up, my dear sinners. Wake up from your deep rest. Won't you say your prayers? Know that you are blessed. I love you, oh, but Jesus loves you the best. And I hope that you choose your own religion.
I'm not a formal person. This isn't very formal.
Yeah,
at all,
yeah.
If you didn't get that.
No,
vibe.
I figured that. Yeah, yeah.
I was curious as, like, I don't know if this is a fruitful starting point, but, like, what annoys you about interfaith dialogue or conversations?
Oh, man. What annoys me about interfaith?
Or likes. It doesn't have to be annoy. Like, how do you feel about that, like, framework or construct? Or what, do you feel maybe, because you grew up in Nashville, right?
Mm-hmm, I did.
Did you feel, like, a burden all the time to be, like, the representative of Islam and, like, have to explain things on, like, really simple, basic levels that doesn't actually get to the heart of it type stuff? Or
Yeah. So I think for me, growing up especially in Nashville, and the mosque that I went to, and the sort of Muslim community that exists in Nashville is, I think they're still trying to find their voice. So they do a lot of interfaith community outreach stuff. And mm-hmm. part of that is because the Islamic Center of Nashville is on, like, a really kind of tourist heavy central street. It's in this area called 12 South. It's right on this avenue, mm-hmm. and next to, like, all of these popular shops and what have you. And so, and Cat Stevens founded the mosque.
Oh, cool.
So yeah. It's, like, super random.
That actually makes sense with Nashville.
Yeah,
that,
exactly.
That Cat Stevens.
Yeah. So he bought the plot of land in the 70s and donated it to the mosque, and they built it. So the mosque has been there for a while, back when, like, before 12 South got gentrified even. But the mosque has always been there. They're really kind of active and in a central part of the greater Nashville community in general. Mm-hmm. But in terms of, like, my own experiences with interfaith dialogue, interfaith whatever you want to call it, they're like, so for me, I studied philosophy in undergrad, mm-hmm. right? I went to a Christian school too. So that's, like, a whole other thing we can talk about as
yeah.
well. But I went to a Christian school. I went in initially wanting to do international politics. I took a philosophy class. I was like, whoa, we read The Republic mm-hmm. for the whole semester in this intro class. And I thought, this is amazing. I want to keep doing this. And so I kind of discovered that I have a certain way of asking questions and a certain way of critiquing things I engage with that I don't think mainstream Muslims do. And they don't ask the sorts of questions, or aren't as willing to ask kind of the more difficult questions, right? And so in high school, when we do interfaith stuff, it would just be like, you know, going to like a, there's like a, like an Episcopal retreat place in somewhere like in, I think it was in Suwannee in East Tennessee on the way to Chattanooga by the University of the South. And so like we went there and we'd like, you know, camp with like a bunch of, we'd stay in cabins with like Christian and Jewish youth, and it would just be kind of like, let's do things together and then talk about God and, you know, but not really discuss like the, I mean, there's something about interfaith dialogues that I never really understood. And I think the main thing that I never understood was, we're all, we all know that we belong to different faiths because we believe in different truths.
Right.
And that's something that I feel like always just gets, like, people beat around the bush when it comes with that, or don't even address that it's a thing. So they're like, let's talk about all of our similarities and not address the differences that we have, right? And the ignorance of those differences, and kind of being afraid of asking those questions, I think is what always kind of frustrated me. So I would be sitting there, and we'd be talking about like, oh, the differences in the accounts of like the prophet Abraham having to like sacrifice his son, right, in Islam, and the Judeo-Christian tradition, right? And I'm just like, why are we doing this? We know that the stories are different, right? One is Isaac, and Islam is Ishmael. And you know, it's like, what does that have to do with like the practical realities of how we live,
right?
Every day. And for me, and you know, in some cases you have kind of the people who like to ruffle feathers and sort of ask these questions, but it becomes feather ruffling, right? And I don't think it should be when it comes to interfaith dialogues. I mean, like, why is it that Muslims, you know, generally speaking, tend to adhere to these kind of strict guidelines of living and whatever, and then, you know, in Judaism, you have a lot of different kinds. And then in Christianity, right, you have a lot of different denominations as well who, like, either adhere to a more regimented way of life or don't in terms of, like, their prayer and practices and rituals.
And within those denominations, there's different, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And so why don't we talk about that? And why don't we have informed discussions about those things? Because for me, it just always felt really inconsequential. And it's funny because I would always have these conversations with my mom too. My mom is a very matter of fact person. And we'd always leave these interfaith things, and she would just say, you know, I don't really understand what just happened. I feel like we all just got together, talked about our religions and this particular theme. And then, like, and then we all went home, and I don't feel like I learned anything that I couldn't have looked up.
Yeah, I went to an interfaith dinner one time, and it felt afterwards, I was like, I guess, like, we just patted ourselves on the back for being, like, trying to be understanding versus actually learning that much.
Exactly.
Yeah, it was, it's an interesting thing. I don't know why we avoid the feather ruffling. I don't know if it's an ego thing or like a fear thing of like, oh God, am I gonna, like, I really don't want to piss somebody off. Like, we're all here to, like,
I mean, I don't think we're gonna start a war in a church basement. Like, seriously, I don't think that's gonna happen. I mean, sure, you might, I don't know. Like, I feel like the worst that can happen, especially like when people who tend to attend these things are well-intentioned and are interested
in
building like connections with a faith community, I don't think it will be mean-spirited or pointed.
Yeah, it's I guess it's just like there's certain fear around that and like, oh God, we're trying to not be like maybe as judgmental, at least on the Christian side, as judgmental as our ancestors or as like And yet we do have, like, you know, it, even if you are like me, like a totally probably like heretical Christian by most Christian standards, like I still have certain truths that or truth claims or sense beliefs that I operate on that are different. And that I wonder, sometimes I wonder, it's like, is even just expressing what you believe, is that like, are we afraid that is seen as a threat? Is that like experienced as like, oh God, like you have, you believe a whole, you actually, you definitely believe different things about the nature of the universe and God than I do.
Like there's something a little, there's something paradoxical about those spaces. Like the interfaith, like, I mean, interfaith dialogue. Okay. So I have these truth claims that I operate on, right, as premises for the way I operate as a person of faith, right? And then there, and you have your own. And so why don't we address those candidly? And I think, and I think the reason is that people are afraid to stake their claims and then like understand and defend them. And I think and I think that fear comes from ultimately like their own misinformation, but like their lack of a deeper understanding of their own faith and why. So when they're confronted with the question of why do you choose to believe this and operate based on this, it's like, it's a question I feel like oftentimes people haven't seriously considered in its wholeness. And in what that, and in what that entails.
That lack of examination, maybe they're like subconsciously, I think you're right. At least, I mean, I'm trying to picture myself. I, growing up, my dad's a Presbyterian minister. I was like, and I would say, I wouldn't like to think that I had an unexamined Christianity. And yet when I went to undergrad at Tennessee's neighbor, North Carolina, and I took, I had a year of biblical studies, one semester Old Testament, second semester New Testament with Dr. Bart Ehrman. And it was the first time when I got like a scholarly examination of how they believe, like how, what's the scholarly consensus on and theories on how the Bible was most likely constructed and written, which in the, like in the academic scholarly consensus wasn't probably by Moses, wasn't, you know, by, you know, so-and-so. And it wasn't even, he wasn't even trying to say, like, he's married to a Christian. He wasn't trying to say, you can't be a Christian. I know he has like teaching assistants that are Christian, right? And yet it was very, a lot of Christians felt threatened in that class, and get like, got really defensive and like angry at him, and that he's gotten a lot of hate over the years. And as far as my own personal experience, I started thinking like, why do I believe this? And like, would I believe this if I had just been, you know, if I was an alien transported and dropped down on Earth, would I be, would I believe in this? I didn't. And ultimately I decided I wouldn't. And now after a long decade, I still, I don't like, I mostly still agree with everything I learned in that class, or like it, it still makes sense to me, the scholarly consensus, but I am the Christian now that has reincorporated that, that examination a little bit more, with more integrity for me, at least it feels like. But I'm curious on if you're open to talk about your spiritual biography. So you grew up, you were raised Sunni, right? Sunni
Muslim. Okay. Yeah, I was raised Sunni. So I was born in Canada. I'm wearing a Canada shirt right now.
Represent. Talk about interfaith dialogue between Canada and the U.S. We do believe in different things.
Yes. Like, apparently New England maple syrup is better than American.
Is that true?
I don't know. I feel like they probably don't sell Canadian maple syrup here. Whatever. Anyway, I was born in Canada. Lived there for 10 years. My parents are Libyan immigrants, so they moved for school in the 90s. And then in 2006, we moved to Georgia, northeast of Atlanta, this tiny little town. We were like the only Muslims there, within like a like a 40-mile radius. And not the only in a 40-mile radius, but like we didn't really engage with the Muslim community in our town because it was pretty small, sort of cliquey, and we just never really felt welcomed there. And then in 2010, so this is the beginning of high school for me, we moved to the suburbs of Nashville, Tennessee. And I feel like that's where really the bulk of like my religious upbringing in terms of like having a community that I would regularly be a part of and engage with kind of happened. So aside from that, so in Canada, we had Saturday school, and we would go every Saturday morning for like from like 9 to I think 2 o'clock or 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and we would just we'd have an Arabic class, we'd have a Quran class, and we'd have an Islamic studies class, and it was very good at like. I think it's what gave me a solid basis for Arabic. And I mean, Islam is so tied up with the Arabic language because that's how you pray. It's the language we pray in. It's the language we recite the Quran in. And that was just always really important. Also, my parents are Arab. So that was kind of essential to my upbringing. I think in the U.S., most of like when once we moved here, most of my religious proper religious spiritual upbringing happened primarily at home. And I think that's for a couple of reasons. One, we had the proverbial village that raised us in Canada that we just never, I think, found again here. Mostly because, you know, when you're a kid, you like reach a certain point in your life to where like you're no longer just around family friends and you have your own friends and everything, and that usually happens like middle and high school. And so in elementary school we had the proverbial village, and then we moved after that and you know, gone. And so also my mom just didn't have the same network, and so whereas like we'd have like little events or like, you know, like Quran study circles and those kinds of things that my mom would take us to with her friends and their kids. We just didn't have that anymore upon moving to Georgia, like a tiny little town, with like 2,000 people in it. So right, my mom kind of took that up and especially like on a daily basis. And so when we were living in Georgia, we did go to a Sunday school, but it was like, it'd be like an hour drive every Sunday. And, you know, we'd only stay for however long, and then we never really kind of, and then we just go right back home. Right. So I never really hung out with the kids there, like the Muslim kids who lived in and around Atlanta and like its neighboring counties. And so we'd just go home. And I remember, you know, my mom sort of kind of incrementally incorporating sorts of like different supplications for us, right? So in Islam you have like the remembrance of God is kind of pervasive in our daily lives. So we have the 5 daily prayers, right? They come at kind of particular intervals for a reason in the day, right? And it's more challenging to meet some rather than others.
Sure.
But it's made intentional. It's intentionally constructed that way so that you plan your day around your prayers rather than
planning your prayers around your day. Yeah.
Exactly. and so for me that's still something that I kind of am working on. It's sort of a work in progress.
I feel personally called out. I definitely plan my prayers to whatever extent I even do them around my day.
Exactly. Yeah. And so my parents, you know, they started they would start incorporating these other supplications, right? So like morning supplications and then like evening supplications, which are the way they sound, like the actual text of them in Arabic is pretty similar. You just switch out a couple words. And so I remember my dad would drop my brother off and I my would drop me and my brother off at school every morning on his way to work, and we would just sit, and for the whole drive he would just be like repeating the prayer, the supplications aloud with us until we had them committed to memory. And so we would be reciting them on our way to school every day. And that was just something that happened during my childhood as like a just like little kind of intervals of how do I explain this? Just like small, like everyday things, you know, my mom would be like, oh, there's a supplication for that. And then we would kind of say it, right? You lose something, there's a supplication for that. There's a chapter you recite for that. And I would ask, and a lot of times I'd ask my mom, okay, why this one and not this, right? Why do I do this thing instead of that? And for me, I think my parents are educated, highly educated people. They're both physicians and also just like worldly people, and very open people. And I think that was something I realized that was a blessing for me compared to like the rest of my Muslim peers. Whereas some other parents would just kind of shut down these questions and would just say, it's because God commanded it, so we have to do it, and there's like no ifs or whats about it.
Like,
and
we don't want a budding philosopher in our midst.
Yeah, we had a family friend of ours who called me Mrs. Questions, because I always had
Mrs. Questions.
Yeah, because I always had questions, and he was older than me. This is back in Canada, and I was like some like nagging 6 or 7 or 8 year old child who would just be like, Muhammad, why do you smoke? Muhammad, why do you do this? Muhammad, why do you do that if you know it's bad for you? It was like, why do you like Garfield so much? Or like, why do you like The Simpsons so much? Because these were shows. And so, and it was just like all of these questions. And the question of why was always kind of one that I would always ask. Because I always wanted to just understand. And my parents, I think, respected that about me and never wanted to kind of hamper that.
Mm-hmm.
And so those were always welcomed, and my parents would answer. And I noticed kind of retrospectively, I'd be thinking about these or having conversations with my mom kind of now older, and I'd be like, you know, I feel like some of these questions you just kind of filled out more over the years, so the answers to them, right? Mm-hmm. So, because I remember, I can't remember a specific question right now off the top of my head, but I do remember in some instances, right, I would ask my mom a question. I remember asking my mom a question and then she having given me like a pretty simple answer that satisfied me at like age 10, right? Mm-hmm. And then I would ask her that question again at like age 16, right? Uh-huh. And then like at age like 22, I'd ask
She's
her.
She's like, I thought we were past yeah. this.
Yeah, she's like, I thought we were past. Well, but that's not it, right? Mm. So of course now I'm talking more about the question. I have my own thoughts, and she'll be like, and those questions, right? I think part of the reason why I think my mother was so integral to my own spiritual cultivation is because she's a very patient person when it comes to these questions. She's very sensitive to people's needs. And I think whenever I would ask these questions, she gave me the answers that I needed for at that point in time.
Right.
More than anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I got older, those questions and the answers became less, I ask a question, she answers, and I accept and move on with my day, but more like it opens up a conversation between us. Right, where she's now asking me, well, like, okay, well, what do you think? These are things that you have to deal with too. And so my mother too, I had a friend this past summer, a really dear friend of mine who was going through kind of an ugly divorce situation, and she's older than me. She's almost 40 now.
Mm-hmm.
But she didn't really have family in Nashville or kind of close friends she can confide in. And so she came and she stayed. She was like having a crisis, and my mom was like, you know, come and you can just stay at our house for as long as you need to, as like when you're going through this. And so she came and she stayed with us for a couple of days, and she was like, and I was describing to her, right, kind of the spiritual struggles that I was going through in Germany, just like in terms, so I was living, let me backtrack for a second. So last mm-hmm. year after undergrad, I graduated in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
I did an English teaching assistantship in Germany for
awesome.
A year. Yeah, it was fun. So I studied German in undergrad, so that's like a that makes
shit.
Sense. and then I was living there for 10 months on this grant. And I felt like the absence of like the spiritual like environment of my home, like the physical home that my parents live in.
Mm-hmm.
When I was like in this new place, and it really kind of took a toll on me. It was like, not only was I going through all these like new adjustments of like living in a new place and having to like find friends and socialize with people and like mm-hmm. getting used to this new job. And
what is this in a grocery store?
Right. Exactly. Like, yeah. like having to find all of, you know, reassign all of like my favorite everyday things to this like new German grocery store. I mean, it was Aldi, but you know, not like American Aldi.
Right.
And
the OG Aldi.
Yeah. It was like OG German Aldi. But a part of that was also I couldn't figure out where the mosques were in my town. I just couldn't. And so I hung out with people at the Muslim Student Association, but I wasn't really a student. Right at the university, I was just registered there for like student benefits, and so I wasn't really active as far as like their functions go. And they were also students and all studying together, and so they were always on campus. I was at work, and then I'd go home.
Right,
and, you know, it's just like, you know, things you just don't end up engaging as much with because of like time constraints and scheduling constraints and what have you. And so, and then like it gets really dark in the winter in Germany and very depressing. And so waking up for Fajr, which is like the early morning prayer, mm-hmm. like pre-dawn,
mm-hmm.
like it's still dark out. The sun has, you can't see the sun coming up,
right,
but
right.
know that it has started to come up. And that's when God told us to pray. And you have like this time, period of time to pray. And
you're like, are you sure, God? You sure you meant now?
Now, right now. Yeah. And you know, usually like I don't have an issue with waking up, but for some reason in Germany, it was just like so hard for me to like wake up and pray on time. And so I felt like a lot of days I would just miss that prayer, and it really would just throw off my day.
Mm.
And not having like the, not having a Muslim community and having to kind of build like a little mini spiritual space for myself was very difficult. Mm. And so to get back to this story about my friend, I had expressed this anxiety that I'd had about my spiritual kind of lax when I was living in Germany and kind of my shortcomings in terms of like being as consistent as I could be with like prayer and the Quran, like reading the Quran and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, you know, I understand why, because even just being here, and she's not Muslim, she's like, even just being here, I can like feel the sort of like witchy spiritual magic that your mom has like imbued this home with.
Mm.
And just like the comfort of that.
Mm.
And I mean, like, I was like moved to tears by that realization, because yeah, I realized how integral my mom was in my spiritual upbringing. Mm. And I think I also realized it's part of the reason why, to an extent, I never really felt like I fit in to the religious community, like the Muslim community in Nashville. I mean, I had friends.
Mm-hmm. Cat Stevens.
Cat Stevens, I wish. I think I've only seen him like a couple of times, actually, in like my 10 years in Nashville. Oh my God, coming up on 10 years. That's crazy. But yeah, I always felt like I never really fit in, and mostly because just the way I was kind of spiritually cultivated at home was the dominant form. Like I mostly was spiritually cultivated at home, and then the community was like our way to socialize with,
yeah,
you know, and I took mostly seriously, like, you know, my mom and her opinion and what she thinks. And then later, you know, of course, challenged that and would have these conversations with her, what I was talking about earlier in terms of questions becoming conversations. Mm-hmm. And, yeah. And so for me, I also had this thing, right? So I went to, I grew up in a like wealthy upper middle class white conservative suburb of Nashville. All the Muslims around me were upper middle class Arabs, Desis, right? Pakistani or Indian.
Mm-hmm.
And or Bengali. And that was kind of like its own, there's kind of also like a class thing happening too.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of us, like my closest Muslim friends are not from Nashville proper. They're from Brentwood, the suburb, right? And there's only like a handful of them. And really they're my closest friends because I've known them the longest, and that's mm-hmm. pretty much it. But as far as like the rest of the Nashville community goes, I never felt very close to the people there. One, because maybe I didn't go to school with them and stuff, but it's also just like classic things like clickiness and kind of drama and everything. But also I've always felt like people just like think I'm super white. Which like it's funny because my roommates, my two roommates now are Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And also in the program here at HDS, we're all in the same exact program. It's really funny. And we live together.
sitcom style. Yeah.
Oh my God. Some things that happen in our house sometimes are just like, good Lord, why doesn't someone have a camera filming this right now?
Mm-hmm.
Probably best not. But anyway, so they're just like, oh my God, Khadija, you're so white. And last night I was talking to my sister and my roommate. She was looking at both of us. She was like, y'all are both really, really white. And it's like, and that's kind of also been sort of like an insecurity with me, right? Mm-hmm. With the Muslim community, is that the Muslim community tends to be like also very cultural.
Mm-hmm.
And not only spiritual, but also very cultural. And so like all of the different kind of political and cultural issues that, you know, the Muslim world deals with end up coming into the kinds of interactions and conversations we have. And so like for me, like, I don't know, I always felt like, oh, I'm not Arab enough, right? But how are we like measuring our metric of Arab? By like, you know, listing off all of like the Egyptian movies that I've watched, or like all of like the Arab pop right. artists that I know, right? And so that's like a part of it. Two, I went to a Christian school, and we didn't have a Muslim Student Association. Mm-hmm. They kind of kept us from forming one, which is like a whole other thing, a whole other conversation on
yeah.
its own.
Yeah.
So we had like a cultural, right? Like the, like, South Asian Middle Eastern Students Association, right? But a lot of the students there were like in math and sciences, and so they kind of had their own little
right.
clique. Mm-hmm. And I was not. Mm-hmm. I was in the humanities and social sciences.
German and philosophy
and political yeah. science. And so, you know, not a lot of kind of common ground between us in terms of our fields of study, and then also by virtue of that fact, like our schedules and the classes we're in and everything, and my ability to hang out with them regularly and what have you. And then, so a lot of my friends were just white, you know, mm-hmm. like white liberal people.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like it shaped like the kinds of, I mean, the way I talk, my interests
yeah.
in terms of like popular culture things. Yeah. And that was always something that I always felt like kind of the odd one out, or I just wouldn't understand certain references and conversations with like,
mm-hmm.
like people my age at the mosque, or like, you know, at Vanderbilt University down the street, the Muslim Student Association there. Was pretty diverse, and I just didn't, you know, and but they kind of had like their own little clique that had formed.
Sure. Yeah.
And they were, a lot of them weren't Arab. They were like either of like African background or like Southeast Asian,
mm-hmm.
and then some Arabs. And I just never felt like I understood like where they were kind of starting from in terms of their social interactions, mm-hmm. and all of like the interests that they had shared in common. So I always felt like the perceived whiteness that people have of me was always like a barrier of entry to me. And also, just going back to this, the kinds of like philosophical and like serious philosophical and theological questions that I had just weren't ones that these people like
right.
were interested in. And, you know, and religion was a very different thing for them. Like, and I realized this frustration that I had, and I made the distinction this way. There's like the practical, ethical side of religion, where like you're worrying about ritual practices, you're worrying about rules, and like issues of jurisprudence and all of these different like kind of technical obligations and whatever. And that's how they understood
right.
religion.
Right.
Right. And so
that's where the conversations
exactly.
were centered on.
Exactly. Yeah. And then, you know, like the issues of like, oh, like, I mean, of course they talk about like struggling with prayer and blah, 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 and all this stuff, but it would all fall kind of into this realm. And I was sort of more interested I wasn't interested in anything in particular, because I just hadn't been exposed to as much. I didn't have really the resources at my school to kind of look into, like actually picking up a book of jurisprudence. Like in Arabic and reading it,
mm-hmm.
right, and working through it with someone, like a fiqh book or something. And I would just have to, all of those questions, like, I kind of worked through philosophically.
Mm.
So, or like kind of understood in a philosophical framework. And so philosophy, and especially when I took my history of medieval philosophies, when I kind of got into all these God questions, right? And it's part of the reason why I ended up deciding not to go to graduate school for philosophy proper, but to go to school for theology, basically.
Yeah.
And so that's how I ended up here.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's like...
And I just want to say I relate to your struggle as being perceived white and having all, you know, I don't know where that's coming from.
Gosh, I wonder.
Having all white friends, parents. But man, there is so much I wanted to, like, I was loving hearing your story, but
yeah.
there's so much you said that like just brought up stuff for me. And I think
mm-hmm.
when going back to describing the home that your mom created, and this very this spiritually infused kind of environment, mm-hmm. where it just reminds me so much, I think maybe part of the problem of like inherently an interfaith dialogue, or as I'm experiencing at Harvard in the multi-religious environment, is just every seems like every day, every week, there's like a peeling back of the layer of the water I've been swimming in my whole life, and like not realizing, I forget, like, oh, right, because my parents also created their own sense of a Christian spiritual home and their way of being and all that, and that was just that's the only experience I've ever had and I'll ever have of growing up in that. And then a lot of people didn't have that at all, or didn't have anything spiritual or religious at all.
Yeah.
And not to mention people having a whole different, like, spiritual and religious environment. And so, like, having conversations about, like, about our different backgrounds, it's like impossible for me to like transport you into growing up in my household and for you to do the same for me. Like, so it's like, it's just realizing, I think, that a lot of religious or spiritual life is like so embodied and so like imbued in our everyday.
Mm-hmm.
I think it creates a challenge, to really, I don't know. I just like, I get increasingly more, I don't know, like humble about like my inability to fully grasp, I guess, your experience. But that, I don't know. I don't know if that's like helpful or not.
No. Yeah. Well, and it's also, I think, so not only like one's, I mean, you'll never probably be able to fully grasp it, as I don't think I'll ever be fully able to completely articulate,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
I feel like,
same.
You know, and articulate my experience, and I think that's why it's kind of a process, and I think it's why, like, especially my year in Germany was the first time I'd ever lived anywhere on my own, away from home. So I grew up in Brentwood, went to high school there, and then Belmont was like a half hour drive, and so I just commuted all through undergrad.
Mm-hmm.
And so my time in Germany, I read very little, which was like kind of in stark contrast to what I'd been doing all through undergrad.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking and reflecting a lot more, sort of consciously and I think unconsciously, because, you know, you go about your day, you're sitting on a train or something, and you kind of have these like flitting thoughts that kind of turn into each other, and then right, you get to your stop and you have to get off and you have to kind of figure out where am I going, or go about the rest of your day, right? And but then at some point, right, within like that week, right, you get to the weekend maybe, and you have maybe a little more time to sit with those thoughts, and they kind of have formulated subconsciously throughout the week, and now you're kind of dealing with them, and you can deal with them, and maybe at that point you have a friend you can chat to about, which was the case for me. I had a real dear friend of mine, his name's Brandon. He, Jewish, and he and I would go to museums together on the weekends, and so on our way to Frankfurt, we would always talk about kind of not only having to do with religion, but just like our experiences as like Americans experiencing Germany and everything. But it was those kinds of conversations where we were being self-critical and sort of kind of bouncing these ideas off of each other, and not really tiptoeing around anything.
Yeah.
We didn't tiptoe around anything.
Oh, that's awesome.
And it was so refreshing to have that kind of like interlocutor.
Mm-hmm.
Because it really helped me sort through and also like build kind of skills for myself in sorting through these questions and kind of getting straight to the point.
Yeah.
And not tiptoeing.
There's one of my mentors, Reverend Ed Bacon, Episcopalian priest. One of his habits of love that he talks about is candor, and candor being an act of love. And part of like what's loving about it is like, if I'm being candid with you and you're being candid with me, there's like, I respect you. There's a sense of respect. Like, I believe you can handle my candor.
Yeah.
And there's an intimacy there too of like, I'll drop the BS, you know, like, this is actually how I like feel about it. And if it's, and subtly, even if it's done in the, under the, you know, the goal of wanting to like maintain friendliness or positive relations. Mm-hmm. Like if we're like not really saying how we feel about something or like saying our, speaking our mind, then there can be, there's a subtle, like, I don't think you can actually handle me being real about what I believe or not.
Exactly. Yeah. And you really have to, I think, feel comfortable with someone to get to that point, or you like, you have to have had the experience of going through that and then kind of meeting someone who's also had that experience of like being candid. Mm-hmm. And then you can kind of meet at the same place, even if you don't know this person very well.
And I was thinking too, this seems like a challenge. I'm curious on your thoughts on this, of like living in a pluralistic kind of society, because as you're describing your experience of like, you know, living in different places and then Germany, not having your community, being more on your own, and just feeling the difference in your spiritual life and your, which affects the rest of your life. And I've certainly been increasingly aware that how much environment affects me. And I don't know if, I think it's something that is, you know, there would be like a lot of talk around among, I think, more conservative Christian communities talking about like, no, it's important to like live among Christians, be among Christians. And then coming from a more progressive Christian background, that seems like it hasn't been as much of an emphasis. I'm sure some Christians disagree, but like, where it's like, oh, you can like it's okay to like intermingle. It's like even good to not necessarily have to be among Christians all the time and blah, blah, blah. And then, but then I have learned in my life how susceptible I am to my environment. That it is increasingly important, like who I choose to spend my time with and who I like would like to, you know, eventually like live with and things like that. And being the importance of selecting and being in communities that, as David Lamont, this Quakertarian singer, activist guy, he says, like, finding a community that's both challenging and nourishing at the same time. If it's only nourishing and never challenging, it doesn't feel satisfying. And if it's only the opposite, the only challenging, never nourishing. Did I ever say that one? Whatever. Yeah. Anyway, challenging and nourishing feels good, but also, like, and I think if I'm, like, never around people that are on some kind of similar-ish spiritual path, that we can be in dialogue about what we're experiencing, we can like reinforce each other's, we can be there for each other and strengthen each other's life, spiritual life, then I'm losing something there. But if I also don't want to, I personally feel like I would lose something if I was only around people who just thought like me, and I would be afraid of, succumbing, you know, shutting down questions. I'd be like, I don't need Mrs. Questions in my life. You know, I'm just curious on your thoughts on that interplay, because you live with two other Muslim women right now. And how is that as far as like your spiritual life?
It's been a really weird experience. because you know, despite the fact that I except for my 1 year in Germany, I was living alone, so, like, yes, it was only a Muslim household of one, right, me. And prior to that, I'd lived in my parents' home, and that was my entire life. And so, in a sense, right, it shouldn't be very different. But it is, because they kind of bring their own spiritual upbringings to the space that we now habitate. And it's different. There's something comforting about it, right? We're all like around the same age. We're all Muslim, we're all women. And so they're just, it feels like living with sisters, right? And that's nice. But then there's just, I'm still kind of trying to put my finger on it, but there's something like not quite the same living with them versus when I had lived with my family. And I think a part of it is because the three of us are still sort of working on our own spiritual lives. Mm-hmm. And so it feels very much like when we're at home, the sort of spiritual nature of that space feels like a work in progress. Mm. And to me, that's kind of how I've thought about it so far. In terms of, like, it's nice to have, like, you know, my roommate wake me up in the morning for Fidget, although she has, like, had some trouble because we've all been going to sleep really late. And so it just makes it hard to, like, wake up after, like, only having gotten 4 hours of sleep or however.
Right, right.
But, you know, having, like, someone to remind you, like, oh, hey, did you pray, blah, blah, blah. And it's different when it comes from a peer who's, mm-hmm. like, around your age. And because it comes off less as, like, when you're young and your parents are trying to, like, get you used to, like, praying every day, 5 times a day. It's like, go pray, and it's like a command, right? And you're just like, ah. And so sometimes you say you pray, and did you actually pray? And, you know, of course, your parents know when you're lying, right? But sometimes they let it slide because they're just like, okay, what child hasn't been there?
Mm-hmm.
But now it feels more like reminders, right? And it's like keeping each other in check. One of my roommates, she is a hafidah, which is like the Arabic term for someone who's committed the Quran to memory. That's feminine, so hafidah, and then hafiz for male. And so we've talked about, this semester has been kind of crazy for all three of us, but we've talked about, like, next semester, she sitting with us and us reading Quran together one-on-one, and she can sort of go through and correct our readings. And she comes from like a traditional background in terms of, like, she studied at the University of Qatar in Doha, and so she did all of her undergraduate in Arabic and all of that in kind of the classical Islamic sciences and everything. And so her training is much more classical. She's also kind of sort of an interesting in between because she's also Pakistani American, but grew up mostly in the Arab world and is now back here and would spend the summers here. So she's kind of an interesting confluence of identities and backgrounds. And then my friend Salam, or my roommate, my other roommate, she's from California, and she had, like, she grew up in a much more tight-knit Muslim community, and was socialized very differently in terms of, like, her, like, Islamic, training, you know, it was much different than me. Like, she has an Islamic studies teacher that she's had, I think, since childhood, and she still talks to that person and asks this person questions, whereas I really don't have that person. Maybe my mom,
mm-hmm.
But not even for everything, really. And my mom might just, like, kind of reference me to, or, like, refer me to other sources, or maybe a couple of other people, but I don't really have, like, go-to people from my community. One, because we moved around a lot and I didn't grow up in one single place.
Mm-hmm.
And two, yeah, because I just never had those kinds of resources. And so it's interesting for me, to kind of realize, and we've had these conversations. It's actually been really fruitful to have the conversations of our, like, spiritual backgrounds and like what the Muslim communities where we come from looked like, right? And how that kind of shaped the way we view ourselves. And I think for all three of us, at least I know for my roommate from California and I, she and I definitely felt like we were the, she and I both felt like in our respective communities, we were kind of the odd ones out, mostly because of our like more bookish interests, right?
Yeah,
things that would bore other people.
Yeah,
weren't boring to us.
I think there's a lot of us here at Harvard Divinity that are we're the odd ones out a little bit in our community.
You
right?
have to be weird to be here. I feel like
right
in
to
some
want
way.
To want to be among like not a lot of people that think your particular way or see things your way. I mean, I definitely I think that was part of my. There's a cliche about it, but I think it holds up of like people who got into like stand-up comedy and get into stand-up comedy tend to tend to like be somewhat outside looking in, at their, in towards either their upbringing other people and their surroundings so and then it is delightful when you find like I mean, are you into the Enneagram at all, by the way?
Yes,
okay,
I am.
Cool. You don't have to like say your type if you want, but you're welcome to say your type if you want. But
I think my type is it's like the one that's split, like 3 and 2.
Okay, yeah.
I think so, yeah.
Cool, yeah. I'm a type 4 with, depends on the month or year, whether I'm like 4 with a 5 wing or 4 with a 3 wing, as you call it. But like, yeah, part of that, the type 4-ness is the individual, thinking I'm so special and unique.
Yeah.
And I think there's like, for me at least, there's like a, part of that is like so been such a part of my was a big part of my identity in my 20s, probably still is, and there was like this pride in being like, oh, I'm different than everybody, but also like maybe some slight sadness around that sometimes, and then but so then when I feel seen and feel connected with somebody it's like, oh cool, and then also like, oh no,
it's like, wait, I thought it was just me.
Right, or like I'm reading some scholarship or like reading some other practitioner from like 200-300 years, like, oh, like I'm not even thinking of anything interesting, like Unitarian Christians thought the same thing like 200 years ago or whatever.
Yeah, sometimes I have this thought where I'm like, the thought I just had about this reading, someone probably had this before me.
Yeah.
Years ago. How does that make me feel?
But what's different though is, and I think this is the cool part, is like it's always, I mean, that person may have had that thought, but not in your particular context, not in our particular shared, you know, November, whatever, 2019 context. And so we can like, I mean, I think part of like, I know for myself, I have to hear the same lessons, the same thoughts, the same stories over and over again. I mean, to some degree, that's like a lot of like religious teachings, right?
Yeah.
There's a reason, at least in Christian, like liturgical calendars, there's like a lot of the same scripture comes up like once a year, twice, you know, it just comes up over and over because it's like you forget.
Yeah, exactly.
I wanted to ask you too, and it's, you know, knowing full and well this is, this answer could very well change over the course of your life.
Yeah.
It's a daunting word, your life, but,
life.
what are your like hopes or goals, dreams, whatever, for your own scholarship? Is there a sense that, are there things that you want to explore that you feel like haven't been explored, or explore in an angle that hasn't been explored, or being a kind of scholar that you think hasn't currently exist? Like, are you like, oh, I think I can bring this to the table that doesn't currently exist?
Yeah.
It's okay if like if you're like, nah,
that's not a daunting question at all.
You're like, I just want to learn Arabic.
Just let me learn Arabic, let me struggle through my 2 Arabic classes that I decided to idiotically sign up for.
Yeah.
Making it 5 classes is this semester for
oh,
me.
Oh man,
not a good decision. Don't do it.
Don't worry, I'm not gonna do that. Yeah.
No, that's a good question, because it's part of sort of what I've been thinking about over the course of the semester, especially like with our theories and methods class, the kind of conversations we have in section, the sort of conversations I have with myself as I'm going through the readings for that class, but then also in other classes. And, you know, I thought I wanted to work on old dead Muslim dudes from like the pre-modern Islamic era. You know, maybe that's still the case, I don't know yet.
I mean, they're not going anywhere.
No, they're not going anywhere. They're still gonna be sitting on those shelves right outside the door. But I a lot of like what I've been experiencing in terms of the my area of focus, like Islamic studies, is all very new to me right now. And so so going back to kind of my roommates, one of my roommates, the one who studied in at UC Berkeley, she did like Middle Eastern studies as like a concentration for her. And she was also much more kind of, just knowledgeable about the kind of scholars that are out there in terms of like, working on specific areas of study within like Islamic studies and then like within like Islamic philosophy and theology and like these sorts of questions. And for me, I did the history of Western philosophy, like Europe, basically,
mm-hmm.
and America a little mm-hmm. bit in the analytic tradition.
Old dead German dudes.
Old dead German dudes, old dead British dudes,
uh-huh.
old dead Greek dudes,
right.
just old dead dudes. You know, in the we had some North Africans in the medieval class with like what's his name? Who's the guy? Augustine, mm-hmm. and then like Maimonides, right? But then that was really it. That was the closest we've gotten. And a little bit of Ghazali too, but so for me, like I'm kind of being opened up to this whole new world and
yeah.
all sorts of these questions that yeah. I've never really engaged in, and my I think my the sort of struggle I'm having right now is answering the question, like, what's going to be the field of study that allows me to contribute productively, not only to the field, but also to, like, the lay person who might pick up
yeah.
the book I write in, like, however yeah. many years. Right. And that's, like, I think that's a question that I've seen, like, swirling around in articles online about PhD students and like some of these books are so terse and like they're impenetrable to like the regular person, like who the hell's going to read these dissertations,
right?
Other than like other people who are going to be reading them, and really they're not really reading them. They might be reading like a couple chapters, the introduction, conclusion,
right.
and moving on with their lives.
Right.
And for me it just sounds like it's terrifying for me to think that something I would, if I do end up wanting to do a PhD, something that I would have spent at least 6 or 7 years working on would only be read by very few people.
Mm-hmm.
And would maybe benefit only very few people. And then that's kind of a question of like, so your question, when you ask it to me, I'm not only thinking about what is it that I want to study in particular, right?
Mm-hmm.
But also it becomes what kind of scholar
yeah.
do I want to be? And actually I was having a conversation with Professor Holland about some of my frustrations with certain like departments here,
mm-hmm.
Just in terms of like the way they approach the texts that we read. And he was like, well, you know, part of like when you're making these kinds of decisions about what department you would want to apply to, it's like, what kind of students do you want to teach? And I thought that was a point that I'd never really heard or kind of a take that I'd never really considered.
He's a smart dude.
Yeah, he's a really smart dude.
Yeah.
Also, I think a very rare professor in just how thoughtful and considerate he
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate that about him. And it I think really comes through not only in the private conversations I've had with him, but also in the way he answers and considers people's questions and mm-hmm. is very humble in class and in lecture. And for me, Those are the sorts of questions that I'm kind of considering. But also, I was chatting with... Let me find where my phone is, because I put it away. but I wrote this down because I thought that this was a really great point that a friend... Or not a friend, but an imam I'd met who's a friend of a friend's had made, and he said, don't teach people your interests, teach them what they need. And I think like, a part of me trying to understand or trying to determine what it is I want to study is trying to understand what the people and what the students, those future students around me, will need. And, you know, despite my interests. And I don't think I'll let my interests necessarily sort of form around what people need. But I think it'll be a consideration I take.
Yeah.
And so I'm still trying to figure out whether it is I want to work in, like, the pre-modern period or, like, in the modern period, or if I want to, like, do something with, like, Islam in America, because that's kind of... I think I mentioned this in class once, just like me kind of worrying about, you know, I never really felt like I fully belonged as a part of like the Muslim community, or never found like a particular Muslim American space for myself. And like, does that put me in like a fine position to do scholarship on this community in particular, like certain parts of this community? But even though I'm really interested in how the like the nascent Muslim community in the U.S. develops, it hasn't been sort of crystallized yet in the way that other Muslim communities around the world have been. It's much younger.
Yeah.
It's still forming in a lot of ways, and so there are a lot of things that I'm considering when I consider
that. Yeah, that's awesome. I love hearing that. And then also now, when by focusing on what people need, when somebody asks you questions, you'd be like, it's because it's what you need.
This is what you need to know. Yeah. And yeah, I actually really like that. One of my favorite philosophers, theologians, is Moses Maimonides, and his Guide of the Perplexed. I read my senior year of college as like an independent study with a couple of other friends. Two other very interesting people, one called James, the other called John. And John was this like raised Episcopal but sort of Catholic because his mom was Catholic. Dude who was really into people like Thomas Merton. And then James, who was this super white dude from Georgia but was born and raised in Nairobi, Kenya, and felt very out of place in America because of just how white America is, despite he himself being blonde-haired and right. blue-eyed.
Right.
And then like coming from missionary background, like his parents were missionaries, and having grown up in that place to like having a crisis of faith himself, having gone to a Christian school. And so we were kind of in this interesting little quartet with our professor, reading this book. But anyway, Maimonides leads his student Joseph out of his perplexity in the Guide of the Perplexed. And sort of like Joseph wanting to come to terms with like the reconciling the religious sciences and the like the rational sciences, and Moses Maimonides says, you can do it, and it's possible. And he sort of forms this idea of prophecy that is very much centered around kinds of certain hierarchies, and you know, there are lay people who fit into one, like there's a certain kind of knowledge that the lay person needs, and you don't really have to give them more than that because they won't be able to handle more than that. And I feel like that, still having read that book and having seen the way Maimonides kind of orders his idea of prophecy and kind of orders society around that, still kind of informs the way I think about the kinds of conversations I have with people and the kind of people they are. And, you know, is it worth it for me to kind of go into this with this person? Probably not, because, you know, this conversation and what I would have to say might be completely inconsequential, and so why waste breath?
Is the interfaith, like, dialogue?
Yeah.
Why waste it?
Exactly. like, why would I bring up Maimonides in, like, an interfaith dialogue in the church basement somewhere in Nashville when I could be doing it here from someone who might actually be interested and benefit from it.
Yeah.
So.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, we're about out of time. Did you have anything you want to plug, or any, like, it's okay if not, or any, like, group or any event coming up that you're like, come to this thing? Totally, if you're like, nah.
I have no plugs. The only plug is, like, bring me food for finals. No.
Cool. Yeah, bring
us food. Sustenance. We're all going to be, like, dying in a couple of weeks, I feel like.
Yeah, definitely.
I can't believe the semester's almost over.
It's almost over. I can't believe it. Anyway, yeah. I feel good. Do you feel good?
I feel good.
Awesome. Thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. This was great.
Yeah, of course. And that's our show. Thank you so much for listening. If you liked it, go to chooseyourownreligion.com for more old episodes. Leave a rating or review. Subscribe. Tell a friend. Take care of yourself out there and in there. I love you. Namaste.
Hi, folks. Sean Watkins here. I'm here to tell you about my podcast/album called This Is Who We Are. That's right. It's a podcast and a record, all rolled into one. Each episode features one song off the record paired up with a conversation with a guest who is related to that song in some way. Guests include Jackson Browne, Inara George, Kate McCucci, and the conversations aren't about these songs specifically. The songs just serve as sort of a topical springboard that hopefully will lend a little context to this new album of mine. Sort of like a modern-day version of liner notes, only much more personal. The podcast and the album are both called This Is Who We Are. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts.